Hey, this is Kevin Bostemeyer with UCI Conversations, and I'm with Professor Eric Potma. He is a professor in the chemistry department at UCI and also CASL, which is chemistry at the space-time limit. Welcome, Eric. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Glad to be here.
Fantastic. How long have you been at UCI?
Pushing 13 years now.
Have you been in CASL the whole time?
Pretty much, yeah, because CASL is also pushing 13 years.
Okay, I didn't realize that long. I thought it was like 10 years or 9 or 10 years.
There was a initial phase one, 3 years long, and then the actual center is 10 years.
Okay.
So it's a total of 13 years.
Well, very good. And chemistry at the space-time limit is just, I love the name of it because it's just, wow. I think even people that don't really know about chemistry that much are like, wow, that is really pushing the envelope way down. Can you just give us an overall concept of what you see CASL is?
Yeah, the way I like to think about it is if you look at things around you, big things like an elephant, and you look at how the elephant moves and what it does, large, it moves a little sluggish, right? If you look at something smaller, like an ant, it's tiny, moves really fast, its little legs go very quick. So if you zoom in into smaller and smaller things, and of course that's what chemists like to do, they like to go to the smallest possible scales of matter, then you realize that things are starting to move really fast. And the motions that we are interested in are the motions of molecules. These are the smallest compartments of matter as chemists like to define them. And so what is of interest, of course, to chemistry is when you have these molecules that are breaking apart, formed, okay? And this is not as kind of a static process. This is a process that is highly dynamic. So you have motions in the molecule that are really fast and that dictate how the molecule is going to snap or form. So if you want to see those motions, which is really at the heart of chemistry, that's what the chemist really likes to figure out, like exactly how does it work that this molecule is reacting? Why does it go into this direction and not in another direction? So why does it form one particular type of outcome and not another? So you have to look at it. You have to look at these motions. But there's a complication because it's super small and super fast. So we call it chemistry at the space-time limit because there's a space limit, which is really tiny, like a very small space unit that we have to be able to zoom into. And of course, the time window is also very short. So the motions that we're mostly interested in is basically the vibrational motions of molecules.
The what motions?
Vibrational.
The vibrational. Yeah. Interesting. So how many different kinds of atoms make up molecules? How
Correct.
Many different types of atoms are there? Infinite?
Different types, or we call different types of atoms, we call elements.
Elements.
Yeah. And so there are about, well, let's say, 118 different kinds of atoms that we have measured. We means people in general, okay?
Yeah.
There are elements that are very stable, and those are the elements that we're used to, elements all around us. Then you have very exotic elements, and the heavier the elements get, the less stable they become. And that means that these elements are short-lived, radioactive, they fall apart. And so these are not of interest to chemists mostly. Chemists work with stable matter.
Wow, interesting. So elements are atoms and atoms are elements. Do I get that right?
Well, you have elements. Those are the flavors, so to speak. Okay. But then you have atoms are the individual building blocks. So let's say if you think about your Lego toolbox, you have red bricks, yellow bricks, you have blue bricks. You can call these colors the elements. Okay. But then you can build something from it. You can take 20 red bricks, 20 atoms. You can take 2 blue bricks, also atoms, but of a different kind, and you can put them together, right? So this is how you build something up. You can use a lot of atoms to make a molecule, but they have different flavors. They have different colors. So they have different properties. And we call those properties the elemental properties.
And where does that fit into the periodic table that is so famous?
Famous table. It's a beautiful table. Okay. It basically lists all the elements, so all the different types of atoms that you can have. Okay, now of each of those different flavors, the different kind of atoms that you can have many of each, right? So let's say a carbon atom. Carbon is the element, but I can have a gazillion carbon atoms in my hand. The number is not the same as the type. The periodic table lists the types of atoms that we can have.
Gotcha. Okay. What about, we're talking about chemical reactions, and then we also know about nuclear reactions. Are those the basic big reactions, or is there other areas that I'm not talking about?
Well, those are the most important types.
Those are. Okay.
Nuclear reactions and chemical reactions. You know, a nuclear chemist may be called nuclear chemistry, also chemistry, right? Uh-huh. But most of chemistry is concerned with taking one atom off a molecule, putting one on a molecule. So it really is kind of atomistic engineering. You put different things together. You build something from your Legos, so to speak. Nuclear chemistry is really that the element, the atom itself, falls apart or is built up from other chunks of matter. So this is really, the nuclear chemistry is a whole different class of chemistry compared to the chemistry of, you know, the Lego brick building exercise.
That's a whole different area.
It's also very different energies. So if you want to build an atom or blow an atom apart, which is the nuclear reaction, the energies involved in that are way larger, about a million times larger than building molecules from Lego bricks.
Gotcha. Okay.
This is why nuclear energy is so interesting, because fossil fuel is like a chemical fuel, right? So we burn it and it's a chemical reaction. Combustion is a chemical reaction. Nuclear chemistry, you need much less material to generate the same kind of energy, right? So nuclear chemistry has a bad rap, but in fact, the energy gain through nuclear chemistry is about a million times larger than through fossil fuel burning.
Does the periodic table, so we're talking about atoms, are we talking about that's what makes up the world? The world as we know it is made up from all the elements from the periodic table. Yes or no?
You know, that's basically the first thing. If you go to your chemistry class, first day of college, even first day of high school, your chemistry teacher is going to tell you exactly that. That, you know, that's really the chemist's view of reality, of life. Everything around you is made out of atoms. So yes, you would say that. Everything that matters as we experience it is composed of atoms.
So now in CASEL, you're looking at chemistry at the space-time limit. So you're trying to harness the energy of atoms and molecules so that we can do good for mankind. Is that...
There are several things, yeah. So the basic motivation that we have is actually to figure things out, okay? So to move from static pictures that you find in your textbooks of molecules, ball and stick figures... We all know them. That's not really exactly what the molecule is. And that's a molecule frozen in time and rendered in a particular way. Molecules move, right? And if there's no motion, if there's no vibrational motion, rotational motion, translational motions of these molecules, there is no chemistry. They wouldn't meet, they wouldn't interact, they wouldn't exchange energy. So the missing link here is basically the motion of the molecules, which you don't see in your book. So one of the objectives initially of the center was, well, let's replace all those images in the textbooks with moving videos. But not just any video, but actually measurements, things that are actually measured in the kind of microscope that we intend to build.
Are molecules, are atoms, so often you see in books, are they round? It's like, yeah, is everything spherical, round?
That's a great question. Well, you know, mostly if you go to your first day of class, you know, even the chemistry teacher would draw little circles on the board. But that's, of course, not exactly how it is. So molecules are defined from a chemist's perspective through their orbitals. That's where the electrons are. The electrons are the parts of the atom that basically facilitate all reactions with other atoms. So wherever the electrons are is the shape of the atom. And the electrons are in orbitals. These orbitals can have very funny shapes. Right? Uh-huh. So the atom can sometimes look very odd because one of the orbitals is doing most of the work and the shape of the atom would be defined through that. But for all intents and purposes, it's not too bad to squint your eyes and say, well, atoms are roundish objects. It's just hard to really say this is where it starts and this is where it stops. So it's kind of diffuse because the outer edges of the atom are defined by where the electrons are. And these electrons can be in very funny positions.
Interesting. So the three parts of an atom are the proton, the neutron, and the electron. And the proton and the neutron, they're in a little ball. I mean...
That's the nucleus, yeah.
The nucleus, yeah. Right. And then those electrons are, you know, it's kind of like space. They're circling or going on an elliptical or
round. That's kind of the old-fashioned way of depicting an atom. That's right. So, but... Basically, the way we like to think about it is that the electron is not a little tiny hard little ball itself. It actually is a kind of a distribution of charge inside the atom. Negative charge. The negative charge is carried by the electron. And the electron is actually delocalized within the atom. So the idea of this planetary system, this kind of constellation kind of picture, is kind of all right for starters. That's not where we want to end. So the shapes, again, the shapes of the atom are defined by where the electrons are. Electrons can be in very funny shapes, very funny positions. And so that's what we think of what the electrons are inside the molecule.
And depending on the atom, that will dictate or that will define what the atom is in terms of the electron. There could be a lot of electrons. There could be a few electrons. Does it work like that?
The way that helps you think about this is that a lot of electrons are very close to the nucleus. The nucleus is positively charged. Negative charges like to be close to positive charges. So those electrons are kind of fairly close to the nucleus. We call them the core electrons because they're at the core of the atom. And then there's electrons that are a little farther out. They actually are farther out, they're more loosely bound to the atom. And those are the electrons that do all the work for us as chemists, because those are the electrons that you can actually exchange with another atom and make bonds with.
Will electrons jump from, does an atom have these are my electrons, or will electrons jump from atom to atom?
Yeah, you can have electrons being exchanged. Okay, so there's a whole set of reactions, chemical reactions, where actually electrons are being exchanged between different elements. There's also chemical bonding where there's a sharing of electrons. So in that case, let's say one atom donates an electron, another atom donates an electron, and these two electrons are basically now shared between the atoms, called that the covalent bond. And so those electrons don't belong to either or, they're shared.
For a common person, can you tell me something that where it's shared that I'm aware of, like a rock or, I don't know. You know what I'm saying?
Not really.
Where there's a bond of atoms or, you know, have a bond with these electrons, what material might I be aware of that would be an example of?
I mean, actually, a lot of materials around us are covalent materials.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So, let's say sugar. Sugar, like you take a sugar cube. In the sugar cube, there's a beautiful crystal, right? And these crystals are made out of sugar molecules, right? Now, the molecule itself, one sugar molecule, is a combination of atoms, and these atoms are all covalently linked to one another. So what keeps the molecule together are these covalent linkages, and the covalent linkages in this case are the sharing of electrons between two adjacent atoms. And a lot of molecules in our bodies are all covalent compounds. Now, the other big class of compounds is ionic compounds. And that's basically, think of salt, where you have a positively charged atom, we call it a cation, and then we have a negatively charged atom, we call it the anion, and they are basically attracted to one another. One is missing an electron, one is having an extra one, and so they like to be together, but they don't really exchange their electrons. They keep the electrons to themselves, even though they're huddled closely together.
It's kind of interesting, salt and sugar. They're very similar. They're granules of white. I mean,
that's right.
And yet there seems like a lot of opposite in the way.
They are different from a chemical point of view. They're differently linked to one another. Yeah.
Interesting.
The forces that keep these crystals together are actually very different.
It seems clear that the mission of CASEL, it couldn't be more clear to the layman like me that this is very important work. If we don't do it, being in the United States, there's a lot of other actors out there. There's a lot of other people who are going to do this.
Right.
So if not CASEL, what?
Well, there's a lot of folks, like you just said, who are interested in this. And for good reasons. There's an intellectual challenge. And people like to satisfy the curiosity. So we do that. Just like you like to learn about the universe around you out of curiosity. And actually the knowledge that you accumulate can actually help you understand, you know, what's going on. And the same is true with the microcosm, which is what we call molecules. And we like to understand. So this is the first motivation. The second motivation, of course, with the understanding comes a lot of benefits. And one of the things, for instance, that you can think about is if you have a catalyst. Right. A catalyst is a material that can actually accelerate chemistry, that can make chemical reactions go way faster, right? And it's a very important ingredient in the chemical industry. Catalysts are absolutely important.
I hear that word. Yeah. I don't know what it means, but Yeah, here.
So if you, for instance, you can put a catalyst on the surface, and then you flow your chemicals over the surface, and usually the chemical reaction that you would like to have is going really slow, but if you flow it over the surface, it goes really fast. For instance, you have a catalyst in your car that basically cleans up the exhaust. That's a very famous kind of catalyst. So the interesting thing with catalysis...
Is that a catalytic converter?
It's a catalytic converter. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So the interesting thing with catalysis, which is the process of accelerating chemical reactions, is we don't really know exactly what's going on. We know that there's particular actors, but if you prepare surfaces where these actors are on, materials that actually have this capability, then it turns out that there's particular locations where this acceleration is really efficient, and on most of the locations on your material, it's not. So let's say I take a little plate, I have my catalyst on it, and it turns out not every location on my little plate is as efficient as the rest. And this is kind of a mystery, because that means that only a few hotspots are doing all the work, and the rest of the plate that I covered with my material is not doing much. Very inefficient, if you think about it. So to solve that problem, you really have to look at, okay, let me have a look at that location right there and see, why is that location so efficient? That's the molecular scale we have to be able to have a look at. And we have to see the reaction taking place and understand why it happens there so fast. And the next location, which may be only a few atoms away, a few angstroms away, is not doing anything.
So you're saying the catalyst, it's all the same stuff, but for some reason there's different points where it's working more efficiently.
There must be something going on
there.
Slightly differently ordered, it has a slightly different orientation. It's the same material, but maybe it's lying on its belly as opposed to on its back. And maybe that's the key, but we have to figure that out. And you can only do that in many cases only by just looking at the individual hotspots and figure out what they are. Wow. That's kind of a single molecule level exercise with the time and dynamics involved to actually solve the problem. So when you do that, when you can solve the problem, okay, which is curiosity driven, but once you solve it, you can make that entire plate that you have completely efficient. That's a real game. Mm-hmm. Right? So then you can accelerate a lot of chemical processes.
Do you have any examples of success in that kind of an area, or is, no, this is brand new and we're just getting into it?
I would say this approach of improving through looking at hotspots of activity and understanding those is really a new way of improving. Mm-hmm. And so we are trying to pursue that.
In terms of the UCI chemistry department, how much is Castle, like 50% of the chemistry department, 25%, 100%?
Actually, Castle is not just chemists. It's also engineers, physicists, and chemical engineers. So on the UCI campus, there's an engineer involved from electrical engineering. There's two or three physicists involved, and the rest is chemistry. And so from the chemistry department, you know, it's a very small percentage, maybe 4 or 5 professors from the chemistry department out of 45, 50. So it's less than 10%.
Are there any other centers like Castle at UCI in chemistry? Any other centers like Castle that are doing different things?
Yes, there's a center for solar energy.
Isn't there AIR? One about, is that?
There's also a center, long-standing center called AIR UCI. Yeah. It's atmospheric chemistry. And those are the two that come to mind.
How about the National Science Foundation, which funded Castle, I understand. The next phase or thing they're looking at is 10 big ideas. Do you have an understanding of what that is? I don't. Can you describe it a little bit?
Yeah, so the NSF is looking for challenges ahead and basically likes to have themes along which to align funding opportunities. And so one of the directors of the NSF came up with these big ideas. And these big ideas are kind of like timely topics, topics that the sciences are kind of thinking about. And so it's a good idea to kind of align activity along those directions. And so, you know, there's a variety of topics. The foundations of life, for instance, I think it's called the rules of life. So from a scientific point of view, how can inanimate matter suddenly become living material? That's a very, you know, difficult and holistic question, but it's a scientific question and we can attack it from different angles. And so, as an example of a big idea, to solve that big idea, you cannot really come at it from one direction. Mm-hmm. So you need different disciplines. You need engineers, you need chemists, you need biologists, you need physicists, you need all kinds of people who think about these problems and hopefully find some solutions to them.
Are you describing the beginnings of the living universe, or are you describing things that are real world today, like an inanimate object then becoming alive? Is that today?
Well, you know, you could have it today, but I think what they're aiming for is really, you know, can we define the rules of life? I mean, yeah. So what kind of ingredients do you need to actually make living systems, right? So out of inanimate material.
Yeah.
That's a big question. So yeah, that pertains to, you know, the origin of life on our planet. Yeah. Why does it happen? Some people think it's a chemical question, for instance. The right chemicals have to come together, but there's more to it.
Yeah.
The right conditions have to be there. And so this is a massive question that goes beyond the origins, but, you know, a lot of different angles are coming together here.
Is your feeling like, is that being addressed now, or is your feeling like that is the next step, that the people are talking about this and that's going to be a big area?
There is already a lot of activity along these lines. And I think what the NSF likes to do with these big ideas is to kind of, you know, align these efforts, put extra money into these directions to accelerate and facilitate this research so that we can have the answer sooner than the alternative is to have it be loosely connected efforts as opposed to a more coordinated effort within a general theme.
Gotcha.
So the idea is acceleration, better outcomes sooner.
You know, for the last 10 years, CASEL has been a major program through NSF. Are there any other recognized to a common person? Shoot, CASEL's not even recognized to a common person, but can you describe one or two other programs that NSF, as the National Science Foundation, has supported, like CASEL?
Well, there's a lot of things that the NSF is doing. For instance, like large operations in astronomy, for instance, supporting big telescopes and their programs. And the NSF is behind a few of those. I believe the South Pole Station is mostly funded through the NSF. So research that's happening there is funded by the NSF. And there's more of these like large efforts, you know, behind which the NSF is, you know, the engine.
Mm.
Most of the funding is distributed among a lot of different researchers. So the bulk of the NSF budget goes to individual principal investigators, PIs, to a whole plethora of topics. So they cast the net pretty wide in that regard. So there's a very wide net, and then there's focused efforts in which they wish to, you know, to accelerate particular efforts. And the South Pole Station is an example that people probably know about that the NSF
right,
is behind.
Right, right. How about space, chemistry and space? Are we talking, is it the same language, or it's like once you go out of Earth's atmosphere, it's completely different?
No, these are the same atoms and sometimes even the same materials. So there's a whole discipline, astrochemistry, which deals with that. So, you know, our universe is also following certain rules, and a planet like Mars is not so different from planet Earth. It has, of course, slightly different ingredients, but the rock formations, silicates and so forth, are not so different.
Yeah.
Right?
I don't think the common person realizes that.
Well, there's also planets in our own constellation that are very different. There's the gas giants. They have different compositions. But there's molecules there that are very similar to what we have here, like methane, water. So those kind of compounds, similar type of molecules, as we have here on planet Earth, are on different planets, but in completely different proportions.
But following the same rules.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the same universe.
Yeah, wow.
Same rules.
Wow. Where, I can tell you're very passionate and love what you're doing. What's on your horizon? Inside of CASEL, what's your specialty on a very simple level that we can understand?
Okay. Well, there's various efforts, but one of the things that I have been working on, and I'm still working on, is to find the best way to learn about a molecule. And so this is a difficult question. How do you probe a molecule that's sitting there? You don't want to destroy it. You want to keep it intact.
Uh-huh.
And so one of the most successful ways is, you know, let it interact with light. Light comes in, comes out, and light is slightly different, and that tells you a story, right? This becomes actually very difficult on the single molecule level. Light and a single molecule don't like to interact so strongly. So that's one complication. And that complication is real, because at some point the signal is way too weak and we just cannot learn much about the molecule. We can't see it. That's one way to think about it. So another way to do it is to bring an object really close, really, really close, almost touching, okay? And so if you bring something really close with a spacing between the molecule and the object you bring very close to it is only an atom or a few atoms, really close, then the molecule starts to interact with the object. There's actually some forces between these two things.
Yeah. Right?
And believe it or not,
it's alive.
We can actually measure the magnitude of such a force, right? That's called atomic force microscopy. And it's a very powerful technology. And in a lab, we are using it. But we're combining it with a photon. So now we do a double whammy. You basically feel where the molecule sits, feel the interactions. Then we send light in. Then the molecule responds. The molecule gets excited. It's going to do something else. And we actually can probe that difference. And so we can manipulate the molecule, let it do something, and then with this force detection, we can see what it is that the molecule does. So these are like funny tricks, right? Mm-hmm. But they work. Yeah. They work. And they actually are very informative for us. Of course, you have to decipher what it means, but it has a lot of information in it. And from it, we can reconstruct what happened to that poor little molecule.
Interesting. Yeah, and you talk about molecules. Why not talk about atoms? Why is it because molecules are a little bit bigger? So we can, you know, why molecules and not atoms? Why atoms and not molecules?
Well, atoms are interesting in their own right. But when you think about the types of interactions between matter that governs life, for instance, it's mostly molecular. So it's molecules interacting with one another, exchange between molecules, conformational changes, exchange of parts of molecules to other parts of molecules. So it's really a molecular world in that sense, right? So atoms have their own place, and they're very interesting, and some people in the center are really focused on looking at atoms and see how they interact. But we focus on molecules. We think they're very interesting actors. They tell a lot about interactions that actually have meaning to us. And so we can see those, we feel like we make a bigger impact.
Gotcha. How about in terms of CASEL is a national and international program? There's many Finland researchers here this week at the CASEL Symposium. Are there any other centers or schools, that universities that you will interact with because they're doing similar kinds of studies?
Yeah, so I like to interact with anybody.
Yeah.
Who's interested.
Yeah.
So, and that's the way it should be. Science should be about exchanging ideas, exchanging findings, kind of advancing, you know, the frontiers of knowledge together. That's the way it should be, and that's kind of what we're trying to do, bring a lot of people in, have a lot of discussions with folks, and have a good time at the same time. So that's the goal. It doesn't always work out that way. We're still individuals. Some individuals get a little self-centered, and they feel like, I want to make the biggest impact. It's not about the team, it's about me. Because if you make a big breakthrough in science, then suddenly, let's say, Nobel Prize winners and so forth, there's a lot of personal glory involved. And so that is very tempting to a lot of folks and sometimes motivating. But I'm not really easily swayed in that direction. So I really like the kind of collaborative aspect of science. And together, I think you can actually make a bigger impact. You can do greater science with different minds, focus on the same problem.
Professor Padma, did you know from an early age that you were going to be a scientist? Was there an event? How did you get interested?
So, you know, I did not know at a young age what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. I think that's okay. That's completely fine. There's many things that interested me. Actually, at some point, I wanted to be an artist. I love drawing. So when I graduated from high school, I thought, you know what? I want to do something useful with my life. And I was pretty good at the natural sciences. I was pretty good at math and physics and chemistry. But I also liked the languages and, you know, so I was doing all kinds of things. Yeah. It was very hard for me to choose. So I actually chose because I thought at the time, acid rain, you remember that? Acid rain? It was a big problem.
Yeah.
And that's basically a chemical problem. It's a chemical pollution problem. So I thought, you know, that's what I want to do. I want to solve these big problems. And to solve that, I need to study chemistry. So that's what I decided to do. I majored in chemistry, and then I did my PhD in chemistry. But I kind of, during my trajectory, I kind of bent a little bit towards the physical side of chemistry. So I became a physical chemist, and so I became acquainted with lasers and microscopes, and became really interested in more fundamental questions. So even though I was very idealistic in trying to solve big problems, I ended up looking at really fundamental questions about matter, interactions, and kind of can we understand those things. So more like a bottom-up approach.
Gotcha. In terms of chemical reactions? Is there basically two types of, you know, are we looking at biochemistry and physical chemistry? Are those the two areas, or are there more
areas? Oh, there's plenty of areas within chemistry, right?
Okay.
So chemistry basically means, in my book, it means anything that has to do with molecules, you can call chemistry, right? So yeah, there's biochemistry, there's atmospheric chemistry, there's theoretical chemistry, there's material chemistry, there's things that have to do with only synthesized molecules, so the synthetic chemistry, and there's people that focus on only measuring molecules. You call that physical chemistry or analytical chemistry. So there's all kinds of flavors.
Wow. Cassel has about another year, right?
Yeah.
What will be next for you?
Well, I think we have pretty good track record at this point. Yeah. We came into this arena a little over 13 years ago. And I think where we are at right now, even though progress is much slower than you wish it to be, I think there's some amazing accomplishments. And these accomplishments always push you ahead. So, you know, once you achieve something, you can already see the next challenge emerging. And so we are always pushed kind of forward. And so, yeah, if you want to continue what we're doing, you know, we are able to see molecules very well now. Beautiful pictures. We can see their motions. And now we like to kind of really understand interactions. So we have not been able to dot the I's yet. You can see them. You can see them move. You can't see them interact so well yet. That's the next point on the map.
Fantastic. Professor Eric Potma, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.